We've been in this investigation lately that you've all come in and out of in different ways around the coming out of investigating the practices that fall under the realm of social action, and that coming from the sense of this, the teachings or the body of teachings that orient around this figure of the Bodhisattva, the one who acts for the well-being of all in a kind of vast, impartial way. We've been looking at aspects of this for a while now here. And for the last few weeks, starting to look at how we might approach talking about big systemic issues like racism and patriarchy and misogyny from this lens of bodhisattva action. Kind of like, how do you practice with those things that aren't actually personal karma in a certain way, but are vast systemic karma? And so, coming out of this bit of check-in and the theme broadly of how valuable the meditation, the sitting and meditation practice is, how it comes and goes in the cycles of our personal practice, which is always true. If we bring that into the framework of like, what can we understand or do in relation to like the big what I call the great demons, the systemic traumas. Very often meditation is thought of kind of strictly in the realm of like self-care. Self-care is this term that's very broadly used right now. It originally appeared within activist circles, talking about like, you know, the necessary things that an activist should do so in order not to burn out. You have to do self-care. And there's been some perhaps a very appropriate criticism lately where self-care has become a thing that, you know, everyone kind of needs, and it becomes like, oh, I have to go to the spa for a self-care day, you know, because I'm important, which is true. You do have to go to the spa for a self-care day. But it's not self-care in the same way that the original, really quite political intent of it was to speak to what it takes to be fighting a systemic demon that will never go away. Basically, if your issue is something like patriarchy or racism or misogyny or any of the great demons, you know that in a certain way the most that you will do in your lifetime is like, you know, trim this demon's toenails so that they're not quite as sharp on the backs of people. You know, but no one slays, you know, patriarchy within a lifetime. It shifts, it ages, it changes, it becomes hopefully more wholesome and different over the course of centuries. And that seems to be happening. May it continue. But then self-care becomes this thing that is a little bit like, you know, like halfway through the marathon, like having somebody just like splash a Dixie cup of water in your face. And you're just like, oh, that feels better. You have a slice of an orange and you toss the peel into a bucket and you keep running. And for a lot of folks doing systemic kinds of work or just engaging with the profound quantity of awfulness in the world, which is now in a certain way more apparent than ever since there's video cameras around to record it. You can actually steep yourself in the awfulness of the world in a way that once upon a time you had to imagine other people to know how bad it was. But now you can just like, you can keep tabs on every war zone in the world, you know, all day. It's now more and more the case that something like meditation feels like, oh, I need to have it as a kind of sort of recharging my batteries or nourishment. Self-care becomes necessary. It's true. So we can think of this as meditation as a personal or individual medicine or medicinal. And this is sort of one level that it is. And this is what we're doing when we talk about meditation as being like good for anxiety or good for stress. You know, it calms me down, it focuses me. And if we can hook into the kind of meditative practice or mindfulness practice that has that result, it can be for folks where it's the right medicine for them, it can be one of the most profound kinds of self-care. In a certain way, we could think of personal self-care in kind of two categories. One is dependent on like sensory conditions or sense pleasures, like the self-care of getting a massage and my body feels better, or the self-care of, you know, taking the evening off to be with a friend and receive the sensory contact of being with them, you know, or the self-care of in a certain way, like giving the body or the heart these kind of layers of nourishment that can re-moisten us, and it gets so dry and kind of brittle with work. So that's the sort of sensory kind of care. And then if that becomes unbalanced, if it goes further in the direction of the sensory and the care part sort of dwindles, it becomes indulgence or hedonism. You know, oh, I'm so stressed out. I really, as part of my self-care, I should not deny myself this chocolate croissant because I'm so stressed out and I deserve an indulgence. And it could go in that direction. It can if it gets unbalanced. So there's some discipline or renunciation necessary to understand how much sensory pleasure is necessary for health and well-being, and when I've crossed into distraction of a certain kind. This is just going to feel better momentarily. There's another side of self-care that is not sensory pleasure oriented. And I'll say that meditation is one of the perfect examples of this. It's not necessarily a sense pleasure to meditate. Sometimes it is, like you sit and it's like feels really good, and we like that. But the primary thing that seems to be nourishing about meditation is not actually pleasure itself, especially pleasure of the senses, but it's the joy or ease that comes when the mind gets a little focused. And so this is like, these are the pleasures of like stillness or silence. And these particularly, and you'll notice this in your own practice, I think, this is particularly the way that, and each of you in different ways, you know, have spoke to this. When the mind gathers a little bit, when the attention gathers and there's some concentration, some steadiness, we're free from the kind of anxious chatter a little bit. That state itself, that can feel like a skill or like it's hard to get back to, or like it, you get back onto it easily, in whatever way, that quality in the heart-mind is itself nourishing and is itself a kind of pleasure. But it's not a sensory pleasure. There's not a particular thing happening in your physical senses that gives rise to it. It's actually the way the early texts say this is very it's very particular. It says the pleasure born of concentration. So there's a very specific thing that meditation is supposed to be in some of the early system that's supposed to be nourishing, which is, once you have some concentration, you have some ability to steady the mind, even a little bit, that steadiness is said to be both profoundly pleasurable, a wholesome pleasure because it's not based in sensory pleasures, therefore it's not possible to overindulge in it. It's essentially always pleasurable to be focused. And that it's wholesome, it's pleasurable, and it's useful on the path. It's a quality of mind that is both deeply nourishing and supports further work on the path. And it's worth noting that when the Buddha, after he was awakened and was basically just teaching full time for the whole rest of his life, when he was asked, you know, what he actually did, how he has spent his time, he would say that he spends most of the day in meditation, essentially in this profoundly pleasurable stillness. And then he would, you know, when he was done practicing for the day, he would teach kind of every day, give talks and talk to people and visit folks who were making policy and running things. And he was engaged, but anytime he wasn't engaged, he was resting in this awesome self-care kind of meditation, basically. So two kinds of personal self-care then. One is sensory pleasure oriented, and one is concentration or stillness oriented. And so meditation as a caring for myself regime is one of the things where we can use to get that second kind of beautiful self-care, the nourishment of focus. Focus is nourishing in the way that all sorts of other things we do might have that quality as well. Anything that you can really steady your mind in will be nourishing in that particular way. So like practicing an instrument, practicing a sport, practicing any skill, basically, where you have to focus your mind, will have that kind of nourishment in it. Which I would say even includes our work, whatever that is. If you think about when you've had a kind of work in your professional life that might be hard, it might be complex, but there's something in it that when you're in the stream of it, you both enjoy and is focusing. Like, oh, when I get to really just focus on whatever you think of as the heart of the thing, you know, building this thing or writing this thing or thinking, I'm going to bet that even if the rest of the job is stressful, that aspect actually is quite nourishing. And so in the same way that when we get creative, we lose track of time and we're just making something, that's a nourishing state. So this is the main way I think that meditation shows up nowadays in terms of caring for ourselves, in terms of caring for our individual stream, decreasing stress, decreasing anxiety. All of those things, getting a wedge in on anxiety, for instance, all of those things basically come down to focus, right? Anxiety means unstoppable stream of thoughts, unstoppable stream of negative thoughts, fearful thoughts. If meditation works for you to get a wedge in that stream and make some space of silence, then it's profoundly useful. And it doesn't work for everybody in that way. For some folks, getting quiet and still just amplifies the mind thing. And for those folks, I would be like, oh, don't sit in meditation, like go for a run or, you know, do an activity that lets that steady. I think it's partly why a lot of folks find more mental stillness in something like a flowing yoga class than in sitting meditation. If the mind stream is so forceful or so full of activity, doing something harder in a certain way than just sitting, more activity basically, something more active, can help to get a wedge in the mind stream there. In relation to social action though, social justice or dealing with the big demons, it's clear in a way that focus or the individual or internal aspect of meditation isn't directly a medicine for reckoning with the great demons. So like getting really calm and still, and even non-anxious and getting out of the kind of toxic landscapes of anxiety, depression, fear, vigilance, anger, shutdown. Getting out of those is absolutely necessary for personal well-being, but doesn't automatically address our relationship to the big systemic ills. And so part of what we wonder as folks devoted to meditation is, you know, does meditation itself connect with that part of my life? In other words, if I want to work toward social justice, say, in whatever realm or issue is close to my heart, is meditation useful for that directly, or is it just something that I sort of do to care for myself, and then I do other work to engage with the larger system? And I want to propose that there's absolutely a way that sitting in stillness and in meditation is tremendously valuable for a larger process, like attending with empathy and compassion and wise action toward bigger circles than myself, toward, in the model that we've been looking at, toward the family or community or cultural level circles, even the ecosystem level circle of who we are. But it's not as obvious, because it seems like what we do in meditation is we take our attention away from the external and we bring it into the internal. And so that seems like, oh, I'm going to only be attending to my individual or personal stream then. One of the beautiful places I think that we could practice more with, and I've been speaking to more lately, is a way that we can use the internalness of meditative activity, meditative attention, to shine a light on or to open or unfold in ourselves awareness of the systemic level forces precisely because they're systemic. So one of the things about the big, the great demons is that they're in everybody. So one of the things that's so valuable to remember, and we've been talking about this in different ways these last few weeks, is the distinction between the aspect of a demon that I carry as an individual karma and the aspect of a demon that is social or systemic. So for instance, in relation to all of the various forms of discrimination based on an identity, you know, which could be like racism or homophobia or classism or ableism or any way that there's a naming of a class of people as having certain qualities, and then judging that class, judging everybody in that class based on those qualities. We can say, oh, there's a quality in an individual that is learned that we could call, that we could call bias, for instance. I learned to be biased towards certain kinds of people and against others. And this is learned very early on. And bias refers to it being a kind of leaning in the heart, you know. And generally we're biased toward things that feel the same as us and against things that feel different from us. And that gets very complex as we try to figure out who we are and what groups we belong to. But I think of bias as the kind of leaning in my heart. And then I think of discrimination as a step bigger than that. That discrimination is what happens when that bias, through unconsciousness or willful action, gets expressed in my actions. If I actually do something, if I discriminate against, say, a certain person, I say, oh, I don't want that kind of person to do whatever thing. So discrimination can be a personal kind of orientation and action. Bias, I think of as the quality in the heart that spills out as discrimination. But then the ism that it represents, you know, sexism or racism, etc., is not an individual quality, right? As an ism, it's actually a kind of social ideology. It's the result of lots of people having related biases. So to the extent that I was taught to be biased in relation to race, then racism is the structure that taught that to me. And so everyone within a racist structure carries the teaching of racism in them, but expresses it differently, depending on all the various micro details of who we each are. And so one of the painful conversations that fills the public sphere in relation to something like racism is, you know, someone says, such and such a thing is racist. And then someone says, but wait, I'm part of that thing and I'm not racist. I don't believe in that ideology. Or, that's the defensive version. And it's so difficult to communicate that it's actually completely possible, it happens all the time, to be embedded in a racist system and be very well-intentioned in working on one's own biases and trying not to discriminate, but to still be part of that system. Because it's a system, it's actually impossible to be not part of it unless you just leave the culture entirely. And so the best one can do is act as wholesomely and ethically as one can within the overarching cultural ideology of racism or sexism, etc., and try to change it slowly over time. Like, you know, European American culture has been racist from as soon as European American cultures encountered folks different enough in appearance to invent race as a category. So it was invented. You know, lots of indigenous groups just have one word for themselves, and it's usually a translation of something like the people, as in we are the people. We're not like our kind of people versus that kind of people. Once you meet someone different enough from you, then you have to find terms for them. And so from the beginning of encountering difference and the category of race being created as a discourse, then there's been racism in the culture. But its expression, how discrimination plays out, has been changing over time. And there are good arguments for saying, oh, it still totally sucks, but it's better by whatever standard, you know, than 50 years ago, 100 years ago, 1,000 years ago. And so as we practice, it's important to, I think it's really important to know what I'm sensing in relation to one of the great demons that is my own, in terms of like, this is my bias, you know, and I feel it as a kind of, authentic is one strange word for it, but like it's an autonomic or a natural arising in me. I walk down the street, I see a certain person and I judge them. I think I know who they are based on what they look like, whatever that is. And I have some label for that. And then I'm either drawn to them or I'm aversive to them. And I fear them, I like them in whatever way. And one of the categories that my inner recognition system uses to parse out people is the category of race, right? And there's usually a small set of like you know, I see someone and almost immediately my mind tries to go race, gender, sexual orientation, class, you know, friendliness. Maybe there's a couple others, but that's kind of it. And if we investigate, what we'll find is, I think what we can find is both the evidence in ourselves of the particular biases that we've been trained into and that have kind of grown in us over time through the whatever experiences our life has given us. And we'll find that those biases reflect cultural norms in various ways. Either they reflect us joining the cultural norm or really resisting the cultural norm in whatever way, but that the culture shows itself in that. And so what I want to propose for meditation is that the focus and internal stability that meditation trains us in is the quality that needs to be strong in order for us to see the arising of those biases as they come up within us. And to see them for what they are clearly. And we need meditative focus for this, more than just kind of a cognitive understanding of them. I think because they're systemic. And because they're systemic, they're essentially like the water we swim in. There's this awesome video that was set. It was like a music video, but it was set to the words of the author David Foster Wallace giving a graduation or commencement address at some college somewhere. And it was just a really inspiring talk around being present and kindness being the most important thing. And it was about basically saying, wake up, you're going to have a stressful life, look around you, everyone else is like that too, be nice. That's sort of the gist of it. But it starts off with this great Dharma moment where he tells this story. He says, I can't imitate his voice. It's awesome. You can find it on YouTube. 10 gazillion views. It went viral for a moment. It starts off with him telling this story, you know, there's a couple little fish swimming along, and the little fish are like, you know, how are you doing? Oh, yeah, it's nice, you know, just hanging out, da da da. And as they're talking, this big fish swims by them and says, hey, guys, how's the water? And the big fish swims away. And one little fish says to the other little fish, what's water? Right? The punchline, of course, being that you don't know what something is if you've been in it your whole life. And so part of the task of someone who wants to tackle the great demons, racism, sexism, etc., is to see or perceive something that is so the water we swim in that it's actually difficult to discern, because to see something you have to have an example of what it's not. Like, we only perceive change, or we only perceive difference. My dad was a theoretical physicist, and he blew my mind with this when I was like 10. We were out for a walk, and he said, if there was a really loud, intense sound, but it had been going since before you were born and never changed at all, would you be able to hear it? And he asked it in just the right way, and I was like, yeah. And then I try to listen for it. I'm 10. I'm just like, I can hear it. I can hear it. And it was like, oh, I wouldn't know what to listen for, because it's always been, it's the background. And we come upon this in meditation all the time, when you get instructions like, notice awareness. And you're like, I can do that. But you can't, because it's the background quality that makes noticing everything else possible. But you can't actually turn around and see it very clearly. What you can do is you can get very, very quiet, and then you get a glimpse in a certain way. And so it's like that if we were to say something like, notice racism. And it's like, and it's very hard to see it. What you can see is you can see actions that are discriminatory. You say, oh, well, this is racist. You know, the pay gap is racist, and you know, police violence is racist, and the way people treat each other in this particular way or that way is racist. And those things can be seen. Those things themselves are not racism. Those things are discriminatory acts based in bias. The ism itself is difficult to see. You can see it if you zoom way out and you take a kind of historical perspective and you're like, oh. And this happens, I think, for folks who, if you dig into one of the great demons and you start to read and talk to people and orient yourself around it for a while, there's very often this phase that'll happen. It's painful, but necessary, where you see nothing else. So, you know, it's like you put on the lens of race or the lens of gender or something, any of the particular harms, and suddenly, like, you see it everywhere. You see everybody acting on it in every situation, in all these microscopic ways. And then, and depending on your personality, you either see it in yourself first or you see it in others first, but inevitably at some point, you see it in yourself, and you're like, oh. And most of the folks that I know who see it are like, oh, shit, this is bad. Because what you see is, you don't see the ism. What you see is what you learned from it. And what you learned is a systemic, meaning constant, pattern of bias. And so then, the root, I'll say, of wise social action in relation to one of the great demons is this turning inward with the strength of meditative concentration to see through the lens of one of the demons, to look for the demon, and to be like, okay, what do I see? And to just start to track it in meditation, to be like, oh, anytime the sense of a person, any person at all, comes into my consciousness, I can perceive my relation to them through the lens of, say, race. Like, oh, race is present in my experience, in my mind, heart. And then I go on to think about something else, I'm anxious about this thing or that thing, I'm not in the context of that particular demon at all, but then I can turn on to it and say, oh, this thing that's happening with this person, whatever it is, whoever they are, is colored by bias. And you just see it, and you're mindful of it, meaning you feel it. And if you're really mindful of it, and you feel that it hurts. And I think the most important, one of the most important hinges in this, the thing that turns it into wise action, turns it toward wise action, is that we use meditative stillness to perceive in ourself the constantly flickering evidence of the systemic ill. The evidence being bias, and then whenever that bias sneaks out past our intention to not cause harm, and it becomes a discriminatory act, we want to see that it causes harm. And all of this is really an ethical inquiry at its base. It's like, what actions cause harm and what actions don't. And it's clear that bias, almost by its very nature, causes harm, because you can't treat two different... If there's two people and you perceive them as different, such that their difference is prominent in your consciousness of them, it's actually impossible to treat them the same, even if the action is on the surface the same, because bias is present in your heart. I think this is why so many of the spiritual traditions go toward a kind of radical non-duality. Everybody is just an existent being. The trouble with that is you can't jump to it. You can't just decide everyone is the same. That can become like an overlay, but the bias is still there. You have to actually deal with the bias. And so what that's going to mean is turning inward and practicing for some time. And my guess is really that this is a lifetime practice. given that it still seems to arise for folks who are very advanced teachers, even, that these the great demons, the systemic traumas, the water we swim in, it's so difficult to see clearly in one's own heart and uproot completely, that this has to just become a perpetual practice, to see these things operating in myself, and then again and again and again kind of question my actions, question my belief systems. So then meditation actually will be the primary tool for that at various points in the path. Without that degree of introspection, I just won't see them clearly enough. I have to be tracking internally to see this process play out at the level of detail that's necessary. Any thoughts of your reflections in this direction?
So I'm thinking there is. Thank you so much for giving us a lesson about that part. Maybe I should start with the question. Back in March it was, you spoke about different levels.
Yeah.
And the bottom one was where the devil was. Or the, not devil, but the negativity, the low energy. Do you know something?
Like 100
ghosts
or something?
Layers?
Yeah. Like... Yeah, like the are you speaking to like the six realms kind of thing?
Yes.
Where there's like hell realms and hungry ghosts and animals?
Yes,
yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
So were you referring to that system that is infected?
Sure.
The lack of vocabulary.
Yeah.
Is this the layer that comes to
It's like
a puzzle of trying to.
Yeah. The way I think about it would be something like, in Buddhism we talk about the three great poisons being like greed, hatred, and delusion.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So greed or lust, grasping, attachment, clinging, and then hatred or aversion or fear, pushing away. And then delusion, like confusion, fog, not unclarity.
Mm-hmm.
That that in a certain way, discrimination is the product in relationship of those poisons being unrecognized. So, you know, fear of one who's different than me is in some ways like biologically basic. We're the kind of animals that like we like our tribe. Right, my extended family, your extended family is kind of weird, mine is okay, so I'm afraid of yours. Like, that's that seems to be more or less built in. And then we override that in lots of ways by creating bigger structures that feel safe. Like, oh, my extended family and your extended family can live together in harmony because we trust the rule of law.
Mm-hmm.
We live under a bigger umbrella. Or we share social norms, right? We all believe in not hurting each other. Therefore, it's okay, even though you're different.
Mm-hmm.
So, in some way, we're trying to deal with the presence in our hearts of those ancient poisons. Like, oh, aversion, like fear.
Mm-hmm.
Fear is like an ancient poison in the system, and it's natural, right? It's part of how we protect ourselves against harm. But it spins out into, like, I want to protect myself and my family from harm. I've been taught that harm usually comes from people who look like this.
Mm-hmm.
Therefore, I want to keep a safe distance between myself and those people.
Mm-hmm.
Therefore, I'm going to accumulate resources and deny them. Like, all the ways that spills out.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, in whatever way, I think of those poisons greed, hatred, and delusion, almost like diseases mm-hmm. that have infected, that word, right, have infected kind of everybody in different ways, mm-hmm. right? And at different times in history, there's an epidemic of one. Mm-hmm. Like right now in this country, we're having an epidemic of ethnic hatred. Mm-hmm. You know, build a wall to keep those people out, and in all sorts of different ways. Mm-hmm. Hatred of the ethnic other mm-hmm. is happening, is inflamed right now. You know, it's always been kind of there. So what do you do with that? Mm-hmm. And part of what I'm feeling into tonight is like, oh, part of what I need my meditation practice to do is to see that particular hatred, that aversion, mm-hmm. is in me, has been learned, is part of my conditions, it's my karmic inheritance from my family and my culture. And the way it comes out is micro-discriminations. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like, oh, I think that, you know, such and such people are hardworking, but such and such people are lazy, and such people are greedy, and such people are violent. And it's like all of those are discriminatory stereotypes, mm-hmm. they're bias, that are part of the bigger structure called racism. So I relate this more directly to the three poisons teaching than to the six realms. But
is it separate?
You know, it's all the same thing.
It's all
the same thing.
It is. Okay.
You know, the realms would be like a way of saying when a particular quality so fully takes root in your life that your life is an expression of that thing, you could be said to be living in that particular realm.
Okay.
Right? So like, if I have incredible privilege, I'm wealthy, I feel safe, my life has lots of sensual indulgence in it, and all of the things that I don't like, I have the power to keep them at a safe distance, we could say, oh, that's like a heaven realm.
Is this one of the six?
Yeah, yeah. So this would be like, oh, I'm comfortable and happy and kind of deluded,
okay.
but you know, lots of pleasures, mm-hmm. you know. And that's different from a realm where there's like, it's all hunger and want and deprivation.
Which is lost.
Yeah, yeah.
So what we covered today was a module in the lower realm?
Basically, we could say, you know, in a way, if we're talking about the systemic,
yeah.
you know, if we're recognizing that there's a systemic demon mm-hmm. and that it's in all of us, mm-hmm. and that's kind of hellish, mm-hmm. like, it's terrible mm-hmm. to be infected mm-hmm. with racism, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. then we could say we live in a kind of racist hell realm.
Right.
That's strong language.
Right.
But worth saying.
Absolutely.
Right?
Yeah.
So like, oh, that quality defines this thing as hell mm-hmm. in particular ways. Mm-hmm. You know, and one of the ways we use the six realms model is to recognize that in certain ways we can actually live in multiple realms at a time. Mm-hmm. Like, I can live in a racist hell realm but actually be quite comfortable or medium comfortable or any number of things in relation to it, you know, but still see that it's this, like, profound infection in the heart. Yeah. Other thoughts?
Mm-hmm. I never thought about, like, the way you were talking about the biases.
Mm-hmm.
Biases? mm-hmm. Like, recognizing them in your heart, but like it seemed like more like on like on the end of like I'm judging, I'm discriminating against another person, but what about being the recipient of that?
Sure.
You know what I mean?
Sure.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, in a way I emphasize the being on the oppressor side. Partly because within Buddhism one of the constant refrains is that, like, you know, wisdom consists in avoiding doing harmful behavior in body, speech, and mind, and being a fool or being, you know, unawakened or unlearned mm-hmm. consists in doing harmful actions of body, speech, and mind. And so there's really the sense of like the only person you can work on is yourself. And so if I'm, and so in a very traditional sense, the teachings for those who are oppressed are actually different. Right? The teachings for the oppressed are things about like equanimity, you know, maintaining your own mind state, not succumbing to hatred even when you're being oppressed, for instance, which is totally difficult. But in a sense, the practice would be similar. Like, if I'm receiving a certain kind of oppression, meaning like people's biases against me are expressing in discrimination over and over and over in a way that like I know this is systemic because I'm receiving it everywhere I go, then my practice is going to have some of the same qualities. You know, one of them will be, what do I do to stay sane, first of all, in relation to this constant onslaught, which will be things like finding safe spaces. But also in my own heart, there's really a difference if I solidify the difference. If I say, well, all people like that are evil because they treat people like me like this. And again, that's based in something super natural, really natural, which is just like, if I want to protect myself, I might want to stay away from folks like that, and that could be useful to do. But if I nurture that bias, all people like that are harmful, if I really lean into that and it solidifies as separation, that may be useful for a while to keep me safe, but ultimately, it so clearly can harden into hatred. And you know, and the wisest teachers from within oppressed groups speaking on this almost always seem to counsel toward like doing what's right to protect yourself and those you love without succumbing to hatred. And how do you do that? You know? And you hear teachings around like recognizing the humanity or the basic goodness of the oppressor while still, that doesn't mean forgive or ignore, you know, while still maintaining appropriate boundaries and holding them accountable, but not deciding that someone is, and the Buddhist term that shows up at some point is like to not cast someone out of your heart based on their actions. But that might mean like, you know, I'm going to hold my heart as best I can in a space of kindness and compassion, but I'm going to fight back hard. And that might be completely appropriate. That is completely appropriate at times. But the core practice of unearthing your own demons or the way that the systemic demon has taken root in your own heart is actually the same. You know, we have to still be able to turn inward to find basically like how has my original goodness been poisoned by the karma of others? And everyone has to do that if they want to be free of those forces. And then for those who are being oppressed within a given material condition, it's harder because they have less access to the basic safe container necessary to do introspective work. Yeah. Yeah, anything else before we close? It's a pleasure to be here. Thank you for listening and feeling into this stuff with me. Throughout this period of looking at what I'm calling the great demons, this isn't something that people give talks within the Buddhist world on very much, so I'm a little bit out on an edge even just doing it. So I'm really curious and open to just your feelings and responses to it as we go on. So if there's ever, if you're ever reflecting on it or anything occurs to you, you know, send me a note if you want to, or let me know either in our discussion parts or outside of how this resonates with you. And I really want to hear so that we can, as a community, refine how we speak about these things that are so important to address right now. So thanks for your presence. Thanks for your generosity supporting the group. And I'll see you next week or whenever.